It's the 4th of May, 1941. The war in Europe is only in its infancy. The Germans have their eyes fixed on Britain as the next domino to fall. This means every corner of its empire is a target, including Belfast. It's a cloudless, moonless night over the city, but the night is soon filled with the roar of 200 bombers on their way to destroy the valuable shipyards that lie at the mouth of the River Lagan. Glentoran FC and its ground, the Oval, are close to the shipyards. The Germans have mistakenly identified it as a large fuel depot, and its fate is sealed. The damage to the ground is total and complete. Everything is destroyed. Stands, trophies, jerseys, everything. In fact, so total that it would take 8 years for the Oval to return. In World War II, Ireland is an island divided not just by borders. In the north, the war takes hold. In the south, the Irish government is vehemently neutral, at least publicly anyways. And once again, football must adapt and do what it does so well. Survive to thrive. Hello and welcome to this week's Green Shoots, a history of Irish football with me, Caelan Kerwin, along with Gary Spain. Don't forget you can support us on Patreon for just €5 a month, where we put that money back into the podcast to get more ears listening to us. Just go to patreon.com/greenshootspodcast. That's patreon.com/greenshootspodcast. And please share the podcast on your socials and WhatsApp and spread the word about Green Shoots. So let's get down to this week's show. So I suppose, Gary, let's kind of start off, I suppose, where we left off in the last podcast. We're in 1939. The specter of world war is ever present. I suppose talk to us a little about where we are, both domestically and I suppose with the national game, just on the cusp of what's about to happen.
Yeah, so we stopped off at the end of the 38-39 season. So there was this sensational win over the Scottish League on St. Patrick's Day, which is, to me, it's one of the forgotten great results of Irish football, that 2-1 win. The draw with Hungary in Cork, Hungary had played in the World Cup final a year earlier. Shelburne winning their first FAI Cup in what's probably wrongly known as the Dixie Dean final. Maybe the Sackey Glen final would be more appropriate, given he won his 8th Cup medal, he scored the winning goal, etc. But and the national team finished rather embarrassingly, I suppose, off the pitch, but on the pitch with some very impressive results. The continental tour had become a thing for our national team at the end of the season. And they went to Budapest and drew with Hungary 2-2, and then went to Bremen and drew with Germany 1-1. Now, going to Germany in the summer of 1939 was probably not a very good move from a political point of view or whatever else, but that's where we ended up from the national team. And of course, because of World War II, we didn't get to play another game for 7 years. But apart from the national team, football did continue right through World War II in our league without too much of a change, really. I mean, we were neutral. The war broke out in September 1939. If you look at what happened across the water, football was suspended, etc. And, okay, they did have wartime leagues and war cups, but the League of Ireland continued as it was. The FAI Cup, etc., continued. We continued to play interleague games with, well, the only ones available at that stage were the Irish League and then what became the North Regional League. We can go on and talk about the way the leagues changed up north during the war years. We had one visit from a Scottish 11 in 1940, kind of a forgotten match as well, which was a semi-international. But after that, it was very much focused on the domestic game.
And I suppose as well, what's interesting is that during this period, it's, I mean, we're physically divided as an island, but you have part of our island up north, which is on the forefront of World War II. It gets bombed. It gets severely bombed in Belfast because of the shipyards, etc. And then on the other side, there's us in the Free State, who are, at least publicly anyway, vehemently neutral in everything that we try to put on a stance publicly. So they're two very different worlds in this period as well, aren't they?
Absolutely. And I mean, if anything, let's say prior to the war, Belfast would have been seen as more prosperous, as the Northern Ireland would have been seen as more prosperous than south of the border. But because of World War II, because of rationing, even things like milk, butter, eggs were being rationed up north. These were, relatively speaking, freely available down south. We didn't suffer the same shortages. So there certainly were reports of people coming across the border to buy butter, etc. That actually used to go the other way in subsequent years.
The opposite way now.
But to some extent, the South, what is now the Republic of Ireland, did escape pretty much unscathed. You mentioned the Belfast Blitz. I mean, there were actually a couple of bombings. I think it was a factory in Waterford bombed. Dublin, the North Strand, was bombed at one point. But relatively speaking, we escaped pretty much unscathed, given the horrors that were happening north of the border and obviously elsewhere in Europe.
So I suppose, give us a snapshot then of, first of all, the League of Ireland down here. What's happening, and is there any kind of knock-on effects from, I suppose, do any players come down to play here? What happens to our players that are playing in England as well?
Well, I mean, some of our players that were playing in England ended up going to war. The likes of, I think, Johnny Carey, etc. I'd have to check exactly who. The league here, there was always a bit of cross-border traffic. I suppose it was more attractive to come south. And there were certainly the likes of Dundalk would have had a lot of northern players at the time. The league pretty much continues. I mean, Shamrock Rovers had been champions in 1938 and in 1939. As we mentioned, Shelburne had won the cup. St. James's Gate won the title in 1940. That was their, I think it was their first title since they won the inaugural League of Ireland title. It was also their last League of Ireland title, by the way. And Rovers went on to win the FAI Cup in front of, I mean, if you take the 1940 FAI Cup final, I think it was 38,000 people went to see Shamrock Rovers defeat Sligo Rovers. It was a second successive defeat for Sligo in the final, but there was no hard luck story this time. They were roundly beaten 3-0.
And what a football up north as well, because, you know, there's I suppose if we take the story of Glentoran and what happened to their football club because of their proximity to the shipyards up there as well.
Yeah, so in Northern Ireland it continued. Initially it continued as normal, but then it basically became a Belfast league. The Irish league itself was suspended, and they created what was called the North Regional League, which was effectively a greater Belfast league. And I suppose one of the most significant things that happened was in May. Well, I think we need to talk about the Belfast Blitz in general. First of all, it was a very significant event. I mean, approximately 1,000 people were killed, 1,500 people were injured, and up to 30,000 homes were destroyed in the Luftwaffe bombing Belfast on a number of occasions. From the football perspective, it was the Glentoran played Cliftonville actually in the Oval, I think on the 3rd of May 1941, and put 6 goals past them. And the following night, one of the worst nights the Blitz happened, and the Oval which those who know Belfast will know, it's actually quite close to the shipyards, and you can see the great crane, Samson and Goliath, from the Oval. The Oval was mistaken, I think, for an oil depot, and it was targeted. Both stands were destroyed. There was a massive crater in the centre of the pitch, and it looked, for all intents and purposes, like it would never be.
I can't remember the name of the river. There's a river that runs by, and it had broken its banks and it flooded the field as well. So it was completely destroyed.
Yeah. And I mean, I think it's called the Conswater River.
Yeah.
And they were able to pump the water out, but as soon as they pumped it out, it was coming back in again. So they were really, I know the late Malcolm Brodie described it as when he put his foot down, it just sank into the sludge or whatever it was on the pitch. So, and I mean, what actually happened in July 1941 is the board of Glentoran met, and there was a motion to withdraw from football. And in July 1941, that motion was only defeated on the casting vote of the chairman, Toby Mercer. And I mentioned Toby Mercer in the last podcast as well. He was an amazing man. He played for Ireland at the turn of the 20th century. He got a few caps. He was very well recognized and very well respected administrator. And the reason I mentioned him in the last podcast was his portrait actually hung in the League of Ireland offices, which, given the relationship, was quite incredible. And it clearly seems that he was one of the men that built the bridge between the two associations in the 1930s and the 1940s. When he passed in the 1950s, the Irish Independent wrote an obituary for him as well. So he was certainly very well respected south of the border. And there's another thing about Toby Mercer, actually. I mean, he's obviously part of Glentoran folklore, but he's the only man to have held office in two clubs on both sides of the border. And it's still a mystery to me how this actually happened, because when Limerick went to, it would have been Grosvenor Park to play Glentoran in 1945 in the Dublin and Belfast Intercity Cup, they made Toby Mercer an honorary vice president. And there was no record of it in the local paper, so I can't find out the Limerick connection. But it was because of the great connection between Limerick and Toby Mercer. Now, I don't know. It seems a mystery to me, but there was obviously some connection with the Limerick club of the 1940s and Toby Mercer. But going back to Glentoran, going back to the Oval, Glentoran and Distillery actually played quite regularly for the Mercer Cup for many years after that. But it took 8 years for the Oval to be rebuilt. And in 1949, Glentoran finally got back to their spiritual home at the Oval. And I'd actually urge anyone, if there's any ground in Northern Ireland to watch a football match in, it's the Oval in Belfast. Now, I will caveat that by saying, in some ways it's falling down. It possibly needs a lot of work, but the character of the ground is incredible. It's also an amazing atmosphere. If you go to the Glens v Blues game, the big Belfast derby, Glentoran Linfield, the atmosphere will just be absolutely cracking there. But any game, it's certainly well worth a visit to the Oval. It's not far from the city centre and obviously very near the shipyards, as we said.
It's interesting to say that, because I suppose the one that we would know most is probably the Markets Field. We go there on a regular basis with Treaty United and stuff like that. And that's kind of the same type of stadium. It's got that huge aura of history down through the years. It's a focal point of what was happening at the time around the city. This happened here, so that's why you've got this, blah, blah. You know, all these kind of different things. And I think sometimes, I know I'm kind of diverting away from our podcast at the moment. Sometimes clubs are a little bit too quick to, even big clubs like, you know, Manchester United or Real Madrid a bit too quick to get rid of the old kind of stuff that made them real special in terms of if it being a dream place type of place, you know. And I suppose Glentoran probably has that. It's that kind of, it's myth and legend plus the atmosphere and et cetera.
No, absolutely. I mean, it's still, I suppose, you can describe it as character, or you can describe it as falling down. I mean, if you take the example of the Windsor Park, or what the National Stadium, to give its correct term now, in Belfast, I mean, it's totally different. It's one of these shiny new modern stadiums. But to be honest, if you go and watch Linfield in Windsor Park these days in front of a couple of thousand people, I don't want to get into Linfield Glentoran argument, but the atmosphere.
It's echoey.
Yeah, the atmosphere isn't great. You know, I mean, if you put 2,000 or 3,000 people in a stadium that holds 20,000, there's no atmosphere, to be frank. When Northern Ireland play there and it's full, it's absolutely rocking, that's fine. But for a general run-of-the-mill Irish League game, there isn't much atmosphere. You put 2,000 or 3,000 or 4,000 people into the Oval and it's absolutely rocking.
Don't want people attacking us on social media. We love you both just as equally. So getting back to where we are. So we've got an island that's in two different it's in two different spaces in the world. Going back to something that you said there as well, in terms of why the change from the Irish Football Association to a Belfast-centric league. Was there a thought process behind that in terms of just geography, or why all of a sudden was there a change from not having a more geographical spread?
I think with travel restrictions and with rationing and everything, it would have been pretty much impossible for clubs from outside the Belfast region to continue to play in the league. And even to some extent, it actually happened south of the border, because I mentioned Sligo Rovers having lost the two successive FAI Cup finals. They went out of football in 1940 and didn't return until 1948. And I think they, even in a neutral south, the travel costs and to get from Sligo to Dublin and Cork and Waterford, etc., would have been pretty significant. So there were implications south of the border, but in general, the League of Ireland did continue as it was. Most of the provincial clubs did survive. I'll talk about Waterford in a while. But north of the border, it had to become very much a Belfast-centric league. The provincial clubs had to step aside, and the league got much smaller. And they're actually not counted in the official title statistics as well. If you look up the list of Irish League winners, I think it's 1941 it stops, and then it's the regional league for a few years, and the Irish League of course comes back when the war ended.
So give us an insight into the League of Ireland and what's happening at the moment. You mentioned Shamrock Rovers, etc., but as we go into 1940, 41, etc., who's the movers and shakers in the League of Ireland?
Well, Shelburne might get angry with me at this one because they won a couple of leagues in the 40s, but
it's all right. We're offending everybody on this podcast today.
Absolutely. And I mean, the only one I'm going to praise are a team. The team I'm talking about didn't exist as we entered 1940, and they didn't exist as we left the 1940s. But that team was Cork United. And even though they didn't see in the decade or see out the decade, they were the huge team for the day. They won five league titles in the 1940s. They won actually five of them in six seasons. They also won two FAI Cups and they actually won a double as well. So the 39-40 season, it was Cork City actually represented, nothing to do with the current club. Cork City actually represented the Lee side. But mid-season 39-40, they actually went bust. And Cork United were formed in January 1940, played a friendly against Shelburne, and were suddenly allowed to take over the Cork City fixtures and finish the season in mid-table. So 1940, St James's Gate won the league, Shamrock Rovers won the FAI Cup. The following year, it was very much a Munster-centric League of Ireland. Now, Waterford had finished second bottom of the season in 39-40. I won't mention who finished 9 points behind them. in the following season, it was Cork United and Waterford battling it out for the title and for the FAI Cup. And Waterford, they'll probably feel a little bit cheated. Not that there was anything wrong in refereeing or anything like that, but Waterford actually defeated Cork United home and away, and they went to the Mardyke and pulled off a very impressive 2-1 win in March 1941 that appeared to make them in, that did put them in the driving seat for the title. But a draw at the Markets Field actually didn't help their chances, and they ended up dead level. So Cork United and Waterford ended up dead level in the league, which meant a playoff. And they also reached the FAI Cup final. So they were unquestionably the two best teams in the country. So we had the FAI Cup final up first, and it finished in a draw. And it went to a replay, which Cork United managed to win. But it was still anyone's guess who was going to win the league playoff. And unfortunately, the league playoff never happened. So there was a dispute among the Waterford players over bonuses for winning the league, and they threatened not to play, and the directors, whatever the dispute, in the end the game wasn't played and Cork United had to be awarded the league title. And it actually resulted in Waterford also going out of football. So Waterford went out of football in 1941 and didn't return until 1945. Now, I probably...
Explain to us the playoff situation. Was it level points? You went to a playoff? Is that how it worked, like a grand final?
Yes. Yes, exactly. So it was level points. So there was no goal difference or goal average used to decide the title. And that actually remained in place right up into the 1980s, the early 1980s. So if two teams finished level in points, they played off for the title. And actually a very current one on that, if I jump ahead to 1971, because I think Bohemians are claiming, probably correctly, that the record League of Ireland attendance was for the 1971 title playoff between Cork Hibs and Shamrock Rovers, where 28,000 people packed into Dalymount Park, and Hibs won 3-1, by the way. So I think that's going to be broken this Sunday when Bohs play Rovers in the Aviva. But as I said, two teams finished level. There was goal difference, it would have been goal average in those days, which is a complicated way by dividing goals scored by goals conceded. Goal average used to decide the league placings, but not the title. So Cork United and Waterford had finished level. They had to play off for the title, and the dispute over bonuses meant that the playoff never happened. Waterford went out of football, and when I say they returned in 1945, I'm always, I suppose, a bit careful about that. Was it the same club? Was it a new club? They actually did play as Waterford 1945 for many years after that. So, and I know in the 1980s, Waterford actually formed a new club as well. But I think in general, the history books do show Waterford, the current club, as being the 1937 and 1980 FAI Cup winners. So even though there was no senior football in Waterford for 4 years, I would consider them to be the same club. But I do appreciate that is up for debate and up for
arguments along the way, were they?
I think they, in fairness, they actually did it. They seem to be claiming it was a new club for many years, and the 1945 was very prominent. I don't know whether there was money owed or whatever. Well, there probably was, given the history of the League of Ireland and the history of our clubs. Yeah. So. But let's go back to Cork United, because they won the double. I mean, we might joke about all the clubs Cork have had, but they've all been incredibly successful. So Cork United won the double in 1941. They retained the title in 42 and in 43, and they actually reached the cup final in both those years, but were beaten by Dundalk and Drumcondra respectively. They had a bit of a blip in 44. They didn't win anything, and they came back, but they came back in 45 and 46 and won the leagues again. So five leagues in six seasons, and they won the cup in 47 as well for good measure. And by 1940,
I just wanted to talk to you just briefly on that a bit about Cork there. Where does the, I suppose, success come from the beginning? Does somebody just plow loads of money into them and they become successful? And then on the flip side of that as well, was it their own success that chokes them in the end? Is that kind of like the seesaw effect?
Yeah, some of it is the success. I mean, they were a full-time team. So let's start with that. They had full-time professionals. I mean, Cork has always produced lots of talented footballers. Mm. But there were other full-time teams in the league at the time. And it was, they were incredibly successful. They were paying good wages. They were attracting big crowds to the Murdoch. But actually, as you get into, I've actually done a bit of research on the 47-48. They did beat Bowes in the 47 Cup Final. But things seemed to slip after that, and crowds dropped off. And that's, I think it's a huge problem, actually, in general. If you're really successful, you're winning every week. I mean, the football fans in Cork, five leagues in six seasons, then they win an FAI Cup. And suddenly they're not as good as they were. The crowds, they were actually writing in the programmes at the time that they need to keep the level of players they had. They needed the crowds, and they weren't getting the crowds. Now, I think it was cases of crowds dropping from 8,000 to 10,000 down to 3,000 and 4,000. You'd be very happy with 3,000 and 4,000 today. But to sustain the full-time team in Cork, and they seemed to go out very quickly, because they actually started off the 1948-49 season. But by October, and it was actually in some of those programs I was reading, they were appealing for more fans to come. But I mean, if you're appealing in the match program, you're already talking to the people who are already there. So I don't know whether it's a case of bring a friend or whatever, or hoping the media would pick it up. But by October 1948, it seems to have happened overnight. The club just pulled the plug. They just couldn't keep going. I'm guessing a little bit, but I imagine the running costs at the time of running a full-time team, a team that had been so successful, it just took its toll. And Cork Athletic were formed after that. They were quickly formed, a new club, new committee, etc. But it's one of the incredible stories of the League of Ireland, a club that only existed in the 1940s, and to be so successful. But Cork has had fantastic success throughout the years.
Yeah, absolutely. But it's the weirdest thing. Like, they literally appear for what, 7-8 seasons, something like that, win everything and disappear again.
Yes, it's. I probably should point out that Shelburne won, I think, three leagues in the 1940s as well.
No, we'll be getting emails from them as well.
Yeah, and I will also absolutely say Limerick were runners up in successive seasons in the 40s to Cork United and to Shelburne, and actually came very close to taking the title that Shelburne won. It even went down. Limerick had finished the season, but Shelburne had a game left against Shamrock Rovers, and unfortunately Rovers couldn't do us a favour and win the league for us. So
it's kind of a pattern that we, I mean, not to delve too much on the decades after up to this period, but certainly back then anyway, if we go back through some of the podcasts that we've talked about, you know, the 40s, the 30s, the 20s, it seems as if that if you want to break the stranglehold of the Dublin clubs, the Bohemians, the Shelburnes, the Drumcondras, you know, St. James's Gate, all of these Dublin clubs, this is what you needed to do, right? So we see at, you know, the likes of Sligo and stuff like that, you have to have full-time players. You've got to be able to prepare to be poured money in into it, et cetera, et cetera. But we also see that the cost usually ends up being far greater than you can maintain. So you might get success in the short term, but the long-term effect of trying to compete with these big Dublin clubs usually leaves you in a much worse position later on down the road. Is that a fair assessment, or am I delving too much into that?
No, I think it's fair comment. I mean, we can go on and talk. Obviously, it applies to Cork United. You can even go back and talk about the Sligo Rovers and the Waterford. Well, at this stage, when Cork United were winning leagues, neither of them were even in football in the 40s, and Sligo had won a league. Waterford had won an FAI Cup not long before that. So it's definitely fair comment. The great Cork Hibs side of the early 70s were bust by 1976. I mean, my childhood in the early 70s, going to the Markets Field, Cork Hibs were the team. Well, Waterford as well, obviously, and that's another argument. But certainly Cork Hibs were the glamour team. They were the Real Madrid, the Manchester United of Irish football in the 70s. So, and a lot of these teams ended up going bust. The great Drumcondra side of the 50s and 60s, they were gone out of football in the 1970s, in the early 1970s. So, excuse me, it is probably a sign of the League of Ireland that we lost so many clubs. Even the St. James's Gate team that won the league in 1940, they went out of football by the mid-1940s. I think it was 1943. They were gone. So I know they did subsequently come back in, I think, 1989, but and spent a few years in the First Division. And thankfully, that great club is still in existence. Mm-hmm. They nearly went bust there only a couple of years ago. But they went out of league. They won the league in 1940, and they were out of senior football within a couple of years. Now, it was tumultuous times. War was raging in Europe. But, I mean, full-time football was still going on in this country. There were still huge crowds attending games. There were up to 40,000 at the Rovers Bowls 1945 FAI Cup final, over 40,000, I believe. And there were some incredible crowds for interleague games as well in Dalymount Park. We continued to play the Irish League, or the North Regional League as it became. So we played them in Dublin and Belfast, despite any travel restrictions. We played them every year right through the 1940s. And I suppose the other thing that happened for representative football in the war years were actually, because we were starved of, obviously couldn't play international football, the army actually played, effectively, we didn't wear caps for them, but these games were described as Ireland v. the Army. And they were very competitive games with very big crowds. So they were played from 1942. It actually became the Defence Forces, I think, around 1946. But those games, Ireland v. the Army, were played right through to 1948. And obviously international football, it started up again in 1946.
Switching our take then to, I suppose, international football at this period too. How, if there is any, how is that going, and how are we playing games? Is it just representative games? What are we looking at?
So I said we played a Scottish 11 in 1940, but that was the last visit of anybody from Britain until 1946. The World Cup, the Olympic Games were obviously all cancelled. Ironically, Germany played international football right up to 1942 and played against countries such as Sweden, etc. But the home nations all stopped playing. And it wasn't until 1946 that at the end of the 45-46 season, the FAI embarked on a tour of Iberia, and we played Spain and Portugal on that tour, and famously had a famous 1-0 win over Spain. We don't beat Spain away too often, but we did manage it in 1946.
Yeah, it was, it's a Spanish team made up of some pretty good players too, is it not? I mean, like Real Madrid would have been, as it probably always is, the spine of the Spanish football side.
Yeah, I mean, Spain would have been pretty much always been a major footballing power, and we did actually play them a lot in the 40s. And when I say we don't win there very often, it's the only time we've gone to Spain. We went to Madrid and won. But 1946 was also another significant year for Irish football, because it's the first time England came to town. That's not strictly true. Obviously, England came to Dublin on a couple of occasions to play Ireland, as it was when it was one country, one football association under the IFA. But the FAI managed to play England for the first time ever in September 1946. And what actually happened was, on Saturday, I think it was the 28th of September 1946, England were due in Belfast. They played in the home championship against Northern Ireland, as it is now, and they agreed to come to Dublin on the Monday and play at Daly Mount Park as well. And in front of a massive crowd, England had a very lucky win with a late Tom Finney goal. And the report suggested a draw would have been a fair result. Now, that was quite an impressive result for the FAI, because they had actually absolutely battered the Northern Ireland on the Saturday. So it was a really impressive performance, if not the in defeat.
Yeah,
I
heard a quote from, I can't remember the player who said it, but he said, it was an English player playing in the match, and he said, when we scored, he said, you could hear the heart break in the crowd. There was just this stony silence, because he says that we got outplayed that day, and we probably shouldn't have won the game. Ireland were much the better team.
Yeah, that tallies with the reports. Another story that I remember from my childhood in the 70s, it was a man called Mickey Ronan from Limerick. And as it was described to me, Mickey had a car in 1946 when nobody had a car. And in Limerick in those days, cars wouldn't have been that common. But on Thursday, the 26th of September, Mickey brought three men and himself in his car, and he set off for Belfast. And they stayed. And Limerick to Belfast would have been some drive in those days. They got to Belfast on Saturday morning, went to the game at Windsor Park, came back, were in Daly Mount Park on the Monday, and came back to Limerick on the Tuesday. So you would have had to leave Limerick on a Thursday in those days, get back on the Tuesday. But what a journey, what an ordeal. And I remember as a young boy actually hearing Mickey describe that trip, and it was just so fascinating. And I suppose in some ways the scary thing about that, this was about maybe 26, less than 30 years definitely after the trip. I could go back 30 years now and it seems like only yesterday, but anyway, it was some trip in those days to go from Limerick to Belfast and back via Dublin to get to those two games.
Oh, for sure. I mean, surely at the time, driving from Limerick to Belfast is a good 8-9 hours on that journey. And then Dublin to Limerick, probably about another 4, 5, 6 hours.
Yeah, well, I mean, they were overnights. Obviously, he couldn't even leave on the Friday. They had to leave on the Thursday and stay overnight somewhere Thursday night, stay Friday night somewhere, get the match in Belfast on the Saturday, and then get down to Dublin for the Monday.
Absolutely, yeah.
I mean, the roads wouldn't have been up to much in those days. I imagine the 1940s cars wouldn't have been able to go at too much of a pace.
No 120 kilometres an hour there.
Absolutely not. But what a trip. And what, I mean, and to see some of the great players, as I said, Tom Finney got the winning goal. What players they were. And it was the first time England played the FAI as well, and that was a huge deal.
I remember reading up on that as well, and there was a lot made of that trip of England to come play as well, wasn't there? As in, they really turned it into a, dare I say, a political exercise, where it was, you know, you'll be greeted warmly, you'll be welcomed, come play, and, you know, bring an English side to come play Ireland, etc. And it really was a not a frosty event. It was a friendly event. It was a friendly.
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, it's also to put this in context. I mean, we had split from the IFA. We had talked about this in previous podcasts. We had got approval in 1923 from IFAB, the International Football Association board to play against these interleagues, club sides, etc. But this was actually the first international senior game against any of the home nations. So we played England, and they came to Dublin in 1946. Scotland didn't come until 1961, and they had to come in 1961. It was a World Cup qualifier. Wales didn't come until 1960, and we didn't play Northern Ireland at senior level until 1978. And again, that was a European Championship qualifier. So for England to come and a friendly, it was significant. And obviously, England is the one, they still are, I mean, the one team you want to see from an Irish perspective. You want to see us play England. Obviously, you want to see us win.
Is what you're trying to say.
Yes, absolutely. And but it is the biggest game still. I mean, if you want to be guaranteed to sell out the Aviva, you bring England. It's even more so than bringing in Argentina, a Brazil, a Germany, a Spain, whoever else. Obviously, massive footballing nations, but the one we want to see, the one we want to beat, it's always England.
It's an interesting thing, because England, and even the English team that comes to Dublin, they're always stacked with stars. That's why. Do you know what I mean? That's it, isn't it? Because you open up your newspaper, even back then, you know, you're seeing, you know, all these big names like Tom Finney, etc. And even if we go back to the last podcast, Dixie Dean, who's, you know, if there's a beyond legendary, it's probably somebody like him. So it's the that even back then, those English teams were stacked with not just good footballers, but world-class footballers.
Yeah, I mean, you're the likes of Tom Finney, you've Stanley Mortensen, you have Stanley Matthews. We didn't have Match of the Day or enough TV in those days, but there was Pathé News. You could see sort of glimpses of them in the cinemas. As you said, when you opened up your newspaper, these were the players you read about, and you didn't get a chance to see them in the flesh because, I mean, travel was a big deal in those days. You couldn't go over and watch Man United or Liverpool on a Saturday. It just wasn't a done thing. There were some people used to go to the English to the FA Cup final every year, but they would have had to be fairly wealthy to afford that trip, and then they'd be going over on the boat and train, and it wasn't cheap. Relatively speaking, in those days, it probably cost a whole lot more than it would today to even go to the States or something like that. So to go to the cup final, to go to a big game across the water was a big deal, and traveling to the continent would have been pretty much unheard of, or certainly incredibly costly for the ordinary working man or woman. So to have England coming to Daly Mount Park to play against us was a huge deal.
Absolutely, yeah. I wanted to ask you about the Iberian tour as well. You know, we're off the back of a war in Europe, fighting fascist regimes on the continent. Franco is still in charge in Spain. Was there a hesitancy to go and play in Spain because of that, the optics of it, or was it a kind of, you get to play against the stars of Spanish football, and that's probably the allure that's a bit too much to turn down.
Well, I suppose, I mean, if you go back, we had played against Spain in the 1930s anyway.
Mm.
And I think also 1930s Ireland, 1940s Ireland was very much Catholic country. And we did talk about, well, Irish people went to fight on both sides of the Spanish Civil That's War right, yeah. in the 1930s. And there certainly was... there would have been a lot of support for Franco. Franco was seen very much as a friend of the Roman Catholic Church. And so, I mean, the reality is we went to Spain in 1946. We went there in 1948. We went in 1952. They came to Dublin in 47 and 49. I might even be forgetting one or two as well. So I don't think there was that much... controversy. I mean, the newspaper reports at the time were talking about one of our greatest ever wins. And I should mention a couple of people in this game because it was one of our greatest ever wins. Joshua Sloan got the only goal in 37 minutes. But the hero of the hour was Con Martin. And it was an unusual thing for Con Martin because he was one of the great outfield players on the Irish side, but he actually played in goal that day.
Wow.
I don't know what happened, the goalkeeper was injured or whatever, but Con Martin went in goal, and I mean, the reports are saying he stopped everything. It was wave after wave of Spanish attacks, and as I said, it's the only time we've beaten Spain in Spain. Well, the men, it's actually the only time for the men. We can talk about Olivia O'Toole and a wonderful win for the women in the 1990s. But anyway, that's for another time. But it was a really top. And I mean, if you look at some of the names of the players that played that day, there was Jackie Carey, one of the greats that played on both sides of the war for Ireland, captain of Man United, Football Writers Player of the Year, I think, in 1948. Peter Farrer, Tommy Eglinton, Davy Walsh. We had Davy Walsh in Limerick. What a goal scorer, what a player. Went on to play for Linfield, West Brom, Aston Villa. Another Limerick, well, Davy wasn't from Limerick, but he did play for Limerick. I have to mention Bud Ahern, one of probably the greatest footballer Limerick has ever produced.
A legend, that is.
And, yeah, absolute legend. Bud Ahern was on that team, and so it was a very strong Irish team. Looking back at some of the famous names, but to go to Spain and beat Spain was still an incredible result and an incredible performance. Because I mean, we took some hammerings there. I think they put six past us in 1952, and. They were, if you ask Irish football fans of the 60s, Spain would become the bane of our lives in three successive campaigns. They knocked us out, but that's for another podcast. So, but to go on that tour to beat Spain was quite an impressive result. We lost 3-1 in Portugal, by the way.
Mm.
But
can I ask as well the makeup of that Irish team, the makeup of the Irish team that goes to play, is it mostly players that play in the League of Ireland? Was there some that had been given permission or whatever, or had come over from playing in England, or what was the makeup of the team?
So we actually had, so a lot of them would have been cross-channel players. So even at that stage, Jackie Carey was definitely at Manchester United. I'm pretty sure Tommy Eglinton, Peter Farrell, etc. would have already gone cross-channel. Another significant thing about that tour, and it's a story for another podcast, but it's worth mentioning because it's the last time we picked players born north of the border.
Hmm.
So the dispute with the IFA over picking each other's players is definitely a podcast on its own. But for a period, we actually picked northern-born players. So the likes of Jackie Vernon and Jimmy McAlinden who were, well, famous names with Belfast Celtic, but also Sons of Belfast, were actually picked on that tour. And we actually stopped after that tour, and, well, I suppose up until the 1990s when it all started again. But we stopped picking players born north of the border after that Iberia tour in 1946. And obviously the IFA was still picking southern-born players, and some of the players I mentioned there, the likes of Tommy Eglinton, Con Martin, etc., were still playing for the IFA right up to 1950. But so it was a significant tour in quite a few ways.
Absolutely, yeah. It's interesting that we again we're back to this kind of conversation of great talent, but that edge that brings us over the fence, I suppose, to World Cups or to championships, etc., is still kind of elusive as well, because we can go to places like Spain and pull out a result, surprise or not. You still need to fight, and you still need to battle to get a win like that as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's true, because even if I go back to 1931, sorry, we went to Barcelona and drew 1-1 with Spain. They came to Dublin later in the year and put 5 past us. So, but, I mean, you can look at the results even back before the war, the impressive win over going to France and beating France, and then losing out to Norway on qualifying for the World Cup in 1937. In 1938, we had a very impressive win over Poland, who had beaten us 6-0 a few months earlier. So we were able to get some really significant wins and draws, and then maybe interspersed with some pretty embarrassing results as well. Again, you're going back, traveling away from home. You don't know. Obviously, it was pretty arduous to travel in those days. It would have been pretty tiring. In some cases, you don't know what state the players would arrive in. I mean, I mentioned the 1952 defeat by Spain. We were also hammered by Austria on the same trip. I mean, 6-0 defeats in May and June 1952 in successive games. You just wonder, were things done properly? At what state did the players arrive in? We'll probably never know. We were also beaten 3-0 by Germany on that trip as well. But we'd beaten Germany a few months previously in Dublin. So you don't... Well, I don't know what's written in the history books or what's recorded. Unfortunately, we can't ask the players from those days anymore what went on. But I suspect that maybe the travel arrangements weren't as good as what they were. Players could have been packed onto trains, maybe staying in poor hotels, maybe arriving the morning of a game. Money would have been tight, etc. And possibly, I mean, there are stories as well, certainly of club and national team games, of trips abroad that may not be taken as seriously as they should have been by the players, and maybe have a drink or two too many the night before. Because, again, sometimes these games can be seen as a bit Mickey Mouse, and sometimes they're obviously of immense importance as well.
But yeah, I think you have to understand as well, because we talked about this when we did the one about the Olympics as well, the 1924 Olympics, where they had to travel to Paris, etc. Like, we live in a world where we live in a world of Ryanair, right? Where basically it's 20 or 30 quid to Lisbon or blah blah blah. This is a world where it took you, you know, a week to get somewhere around Europe, you know, with a train and a boat or whatever, etc. So it's very different to what it is now, and also from a player's point of view, you know, unless, you know, there's something serious on the line, you know, if you're going somewhere for a friendly, you are going to kind of treat it maybe a little bit like a, I'm not saying that they did, by the way, I'm not casting any aspersions on somebody, but I'm just saying from their point of view, you don't get to travel much. You don't get out of Ireland much. Here you are, you have an opportunity, you know, in whatever country to almost have a working holiday where, you know, you get to play a game of football. Plus, you know, you get to maybe unwind a little bit too.
Yeah, there is. And I mean, these, as you say, travel in those days was very much a novelty. I mean, I know my father was born in 1939. He didn't go outside of Limerick until he was 14 in 1953, when he got on a train on his own to go to Dundalk to watch Limerick win the Shield. As a 14-year-old, it was his first time leaving Limerick.
Wow.
And it would have been pretty much the same for most people. I mean, it's my grandparents didn't get on a plane until, I think, well into the 1970s. They were already grandparents long before they ever sat in a plane. It was very much different times. Travel was incredibly expensive, and it wasn't something the normal working person really considered or could afford. That they were more concerned with putting bread on the table than the cheap Ryanair flight to Lisbon, as you say.
Interesting, yeah. And so we kind of go through this period of 1939 to 1946-47-ish. Where are we in terms of, I suppose, if we go to League of Ireland first, where are we in terms of the health of the league domestically? We've talked about a couple of teams that kind of, you know, like Cork, they appear and then they disappear, etc. So is the league in a good place at this time?
Yeah, so I think the league comes out of the war period in a good place, with crowds are certainly up. And I mean, after World War II in England, there was a significant crowd boost, and people were just desperate for normality and for football, live football. We had a boost certainly here in 45, 46, 47. The attendances at the cup finals were up. The attendances at the interleague were pretty significant. International football came back in 1946. And so that was great. The teams were able to come back to Dublin again. As I said, we played England in 1946. We were back playing regular international football after that. You had Irish players starring across the water. The likes of Jackie Carey, etc., mentioned, became Footballer of the Year in 1948. I think Irish football domestically and internationally was in good shape. Shelburne had probably just taken over the mantle from Cork United, who had, they'd won the league the last time in 46, they won the cup in 47, but they were on the way down. And we can go on and talk about the late 40s and the 50s again, because football, it was a good time for Irish football. Crowds were significant. There weren't a lot of other attractions, which is probably important to say. You could go to the cinema and you could watch movies, which was obviously huge. As I said, you had Pathé News in those cinemas as well, so you could see a few minutes of football. So you might see a big game from England, an FA Cup final or something like that, or an English international. Some of our games are available in Pathé News as well. I'd highly recommend just googling some of them. The footage is really fascinating to watch. But in general, football was a live sport. You didn't have television in those days. You could listen to games on the radio, okay, but as far as people were concerned in Dublin, football was something that happened at Dalymount Park or at Talca Park or Shelburne Park. You went and watched your local team. It was a live game, and the crowds were going in the thousands, and certainly far higher crowds than we're used to seeing today.
Can I just ask as well, because we started off the show with kind of looking a little bit at Northern Ireland football, you know, because of the war, etc. Do you know, I suppose, what happens post 1949 to Northern Ireland football? Because we kind of talked about, you know, they had to change the league, it becomes more Belfast centric, etc. What happens afterwards? Does it kind of go back to the way it was before? Does it create new powerhouses up there in terms of football clubs, etc.? What happens? Do we know?
Well, yeah, so it was a significant time north of the border as well. So the North Regional League existed during the war, but after the war, they went back to the Irish League. The Irish Cup had continued. Now, Glentoran were always, I suppose, a significant club north of the border, but they were well behind Linfield, and they still are. I'm not going to get into that argument again in league titles and cups won, but that is a fact. But a significant powerhouse in Belfast at the time was Belfast Celtic, and the big two in Belfast in the 1940s were undoubtedly Linfield and Celtic. And I suppose a significant moment happened in Boxing Day, as they would call it, 1948, when Linfield played Celtic at Windsor Park, and some of the crowd invaded the pitch and attacked Jimmy Jones, a star striker for Belfast Celtic, and he got badly injured. He got his leg broken. There was a lot of trouble after that. There were fines. Windsor Park was closed for a couple of games, and at the end of night that season, Belfast Celtic made the very faithful decision to withdraw from Irish League football. They'd gone on a tour of North America, which again was an incredible thing. They were the first Irish team ever to cross the Atlantic, and not only did they go to North America, they played the Scottish national team and they beat them 2-0 in one of the most phenomenal, sensational results in history, really, in Scotland. Wow. Don't generally tend to play club sides, and I wonder why. But the sad thing is they went out of football after that, and it was really Glentoran came to prominence much more after that, and it became Linfield and Glentoran who are the big two today in Irish League football. Mm. But for very much of the 40s, it was either Linfield or Celtic winning the league or the cup. Distillery were reasonably strong in those days as well. They're obviously still going, but unfortunately a shadow of the great club that competed for honours for so many years.
Mm, absolutely, yeah. I think as we say often enough on this podcast, it'd be interesting to do a podcast solely on Belfast Celtic, because they have cropped up quite a lot in our podcasts so far up to this episode 5, most assuredly, and a number of clubs too. Gary, thanks very much again, as ever, another fascinating insight into Irish football. We're creeping up into the mid 40s and into the 50s now of Irish football as well. We've come on such a journey, and it's been such a fascinating journey, I think, to look at the ins and outs of how football, I suppose, more than anything, survived through, I suppose, 40, 50 years of incredible period of Irish football as well. So, Gary, thanks very much, and we look forward to the next time.
Absolutely. Thanks, Colin.
Well, that's it for this week's show. Don't forget you can support us on Patreon for just €5 a month, where we put that money back into the podcast to get more ears listening to us. Just go to patreon.com/greenshootspodcast. That's patreon.com/greenshootspodcast. Please share the podcast on your socials and WhatsApp and spread the word about the show. Remember to support your local League of Ireland club. It's our heritage. It's our game. Until next week, bye for now.